You're listening to 90.3 KNBA, Alaska's Native Voice. It's Morning Line, and I've got a guest in the studio. It's Matthew Gilbert, who's an author. Welcome aboard, Matthew.
Thank you.
So tell me about your experience here. You know, I see that you've got this book out, and here it is, Sitting at Their Feet, A Young Gwich'in at the Baskins Memoir. And I'll let you tackle the Gwich'in part.
In Gwich'in, it's pronounced Gokwai Ehaidi, the Sitting at Their Feet. It's a, like, real humble title, but I'll explain later.
Yeah, so you wrote this book, and what motivated you to do that?
Definitely the elder stories. I translated for a master's project for my master's degree. It was back in 2010, I believe. I was getting my master, and I believe you were working at UAF too at the time.
That's right.
So I was translating a bunch of this compilation of cassette tapes of elder stories from my village that a school teacher was wise enough to record. And I learned that these elders of mine, which were, unfortunately, they were all gone by then because they were like in their 80s, 90s when I was a kid. They had just momentous accomplishments and journeys and adventures. And I went around, traveled the world, and I finished college, and I got 2 degrees, and I thought my accomplishments and travels were great, and I felt so small when I read their stories, though, because they did way more than I did. And so that's why I titled it Sitting at Their Feet. That's why it's a humble title, you know, because I'm like, okay, I was a kid, and, you know, I actually did sit at the feet of some of these elders when the teachers brought us to their houses when I was a kid. And so at 30 years old, all my accomplishments, all my my 2 degrees from UAA and UAF, I still felt like I was sitting at their feet, you know? I was like, okay, I went full circle. I'm sitting at their feet again because I feel so humbled by them, you know? And their stories are in the book, too. You'll get snippets of it.
So you found these tapes, and there were tapes of your language, Gwich'in.
Yeah.
Wow, so that's amazing, and you were able to translate them and transcribe them.
No way. No. They were like they spoke the old Gwich'in language, which is like not really spoken anymore. So I got a grant from the Alaska Humanities Forum, and I actually hired my grandpa Trimble Gilbert, who is the last person probably on the planet that understands the old language, the Gwich'in. So with the grant, I hired him to listen to the tapes, and we'd go over. It was a lot of work. I don't think I worked that hard my whole life. We had to draw pictures. We had to write notes. We had to do all sorts of stuff to translate it from Gwich'in to English. Yeah. So it was quite a challenge, but it was my grandpa that translated the tapes.
Oh, wow. But it sounds like kind of like this treasure store.
It was.
What would have happened if you hadn't found those tapes?
Oh, man. They probably would just have sat there and just nothing would happen. A lot of people told me it was my destiny. I don't want to get big-headed about it. I think maybe one day somebody would have maybe, I don't know, somehow translated. I mean, but... Okay, I'll take the credit. Yeah, that was a great accomplishment. It was probably the greatest accomplishment of my life, you know? Like, when I'm an old man, I'll look back on and say, you know, at least I did that. At least I restored some of my people's history, you know?
And so this book, it's... I haven't seen it on the shelves at the store lately. How do people get a hold of it?
It's on Amazon. I actually tried publishing it multiple times, but... Fortunately, the publishers are not actually wanting it at the moment. But, you know, I put a display up just to test it out in like a mini mall. And people grabbed it right away. I put it out at the Writers Conference, like in 2011, Alaska Writers Conference. People just, it sold like in 1 hour. Same thing at the Tanna Chiefs Conference, the lobby area. one lunch hour, I just put a sample of the book up in a sign up sheet. Like not even 30 minutes, I had 40 people sign up to want it. So the public definitely wants it. It's just the publishers feel differently.
Right. Well, I don't know if Alaska is a niche market when it comes to something that's not directly to tourists. Hard to tell, right?
Well, this is mostly, and you'll probably understand this being a former university person, it's mostly, I guess I saw my market as like the university circuit, like where people could, or the high school circuit where people could, and tribal high schools or tribal colleges, they could use it for like Native American studies programs. You know, that's how I saw it. Yeah, because I'm such an academic.
Right on. And so, yeah, it does look super organized and well laid out. I see these various chapter headings. And how long did it take to put this whole thing together?
6 years.
6 years out of your life, and you've
6 years out of my life. Yeah, it just took editing, and running it by my writing mentors, and you know, a couple of them like really like made a lot of edits, and I had to go over and do all of them, and publishers would send back like not so kind letters saying, you know, this needs to be done. It's not structured right, but I held on to the structure of the book. I think it's put together just right, and I don't see, and all my friends agree with me too, and not just because they're my friend. I told them to be critical too, and they all agreed with me that it's put together okay, and so I'm just leaving it like it is and giving the publishers a rest for a while, and just I mainly self-published for my aunt. She really wanted a copy, and plus there was a couple of people that really wanted copies, but it was mostly for my aunt. I self-published it because she really got impatient and wanted her copy because like I said, the publishers weren't going for it and she wanted to read it, so it's mainly for her. I self-published.
And so how about folks in your home community? Were they receptive to this?
They liked it. I don't think too many of them read it yet. I haven't had enough money to purchase bulk supply. I think I will soon with my I'm a contracted map researcher for Tanana Chiefs Conference and CATG, Council of Athabasca Tribal Governments, working with traditional place name maps. So the oral histories led on to the place names research, and yeah, my graduate advisors kept telling me, you know, once you get into this cultural preservation stuff, it's not going to end. And I'll just do this elder story. It'll end. And here I am 7 years later, just still in it. They were right. You know, like, yeah. So I'm still doing preservation work, but it's more with place name mapping with elders and hunters and stuff. And I guess it's a big thing now with the government.
I've heard that's kind of something that's coming back, to take back these names of places that were had indigenous importance, and relating what the names were. Yeah, some of it might be, would you say, like traditional ecological knowledge?
Yeah.
That sort of thing.
Yeah.
Do you get into any of that in the book?
No, that came later after the book. Yeah, the book just is mainly me growing up, a coming of age story. Should I talk about it now? Just go through it really fast?
Okay.
So it starts off with like my childhood in the village, and it's not, it's the big events that unfolded, like the 1988 Gwich'in gathering, when the Gwich'in stood up against the government and oil companies to protect the Arctic refuge, which is a huge issue in Alaska and the country. I talk about just the details of that, you know, of how we experienced it as kids, you know, all these people coming to the village and what it did. We didn't know what it meant at the time. Later on, I found out what it meant. And then growing up, just normal coming of age story in the village, fun times. And then high school, I actually started an education journey where I went to Chimaua, didn't really work out. Just wasn't challenging enough, and so I went, came back home, and then I went to stay with my aunt in Reno and tried to go high school there because that was my only option. the education quality, it surprisingly wasn't that different from the village. I thought that was a huge surprise, you know. So it was a little, they did require you to do more work, but in terms of the quality. So, and then came college, and I didn't want to go here. I wanted to go somewhere else. So I went to California, but that didn't work out. So I came back, finished at UAA, actually. So it's been a struggle trying to find, like, the best education I could when I was a young kid. Not many kids do that. Take their life in their own hands and go out and go to the school they want. a little different that way. Hopefully there's better opportunities now for Native kids in the village, you know, and I still work to do my part to make that happen in any way I can. And then I'm just going to weave through the rest of it. After graduating from college, I did some community organizing. I interned in Washington, D.C., and I actually studied a little bit at Oxford in England. Yeah, I don't want to, like, you know, brag too much. You know, I mean, us Native guys, we don't talk about ourselves that much, but I'm just telling you what's in the book, and I'm just giving you my reflection on all these experiences that, unfortunately, as I said, not many Native guys, definitely from my generation, didn't get to experience. So I thought I wanted to share the reflections of a Native guy in England or in college or graduating college, what it feels and what it, like, what it means. Native kids and young Native people and any age of Native people, but particularly young Native people, live my life and learn from my life so they could go further, because they might read my... College isn't for everybody, you know? Some people just go to training. Somebody might read my story like, yeah, that sounds fun, but I'd rather just go to training and, you know, but at least they could learn from my story at the same time. Anyways, there's a lot here, so I'll go quickly. We don't have a lot of time, so... The next part of the memoir, I talk about when I got into tribal politics. I became like a tribal administrator, and then I was frustrated with all the social ills and social issues, and how I feel like no matter what I did or how smart a thing I did or how hard I worked in tribal government, nothing was changing. So I wanted to see what it was like. Since I had friends, because I went to a conference, I had a bunch of friends on other reservations. I actually took my PFD one winter, and I actually got a ride on Craigslist from a Vietnam veteran, and we drove. He was going to Tennessee, and he gave me a ride to Pine Ridge, where I met up with my friends Wayne and Alex, and I actually got to drive around Pine Ridge and go to Wounded Knee, and went to the tribal government and met a retired tribal president. I wasn't able to meet the real one. He was traveling. I learned about their issues, and I went on radio like this and explained the issues of Alaska Natives, and they were saying a lot of what we're going through, the same thing they're going through. And there was an announcement on Lakota radio that the accountant, like, I don't know, like, quit, or and everybody want their paycheck. So right there, I just, yeah, I could see it's the same all over, you know. I mean, it's the same stress as, like, you know, Nordic Village, just maybe a little different. And then from there, I went to Navajo Nation. That was a little different. It was bigger, more impersonal. I mean, I don't want to say anything offensive, but it was more impersonal than Lakota, the Pine Ridge, because I got... There's just more a sense of a community there. I didn't get that in Navajo Nation. I did in part. There's pockets of community, but it's so huge. Maybe that's why. But, and then after that, I went to visit the fishing tribe in Washington. They were very interesting people. They had casinos, and an elder sat down and explained all the tribes around the Olympic Peninsula. And so I came home, and I came home right in time for a huge meeting about the Doyon Land Exchange, which was a huge issue in 2005 because it was threatening, like, the Yukon River. I feel like I'm talking too fast. I came home just in time for that big meeting, and I stood with my people again, just like in 88, and it worked. Doyon, I think at the time, tabled the land exchange issue, and that issue died down. So everything like kind of died down, and I was traveling a lot, like going to Santa Fe, going to Anchorage, back and forth to Anchorage, conferences, and pretty soon, and I was a tribal judge too, and I also actually had to take over the tribal elections at one point, and not counting all the other stuff, and you'll read about, whoever buys this book will read about everything I did. I don't want to go into it, but I eventually got burned out in 2009. I went back to school and to UAF, and graduate school was just a cakewalk compared to tribal government. The thing is, I was handling tribal government, and so I wanted to go outside for school because I already graduated in Alaska, but I found out about all these issues that didn't get written about, and so I wanted to write about them. Like, I wrote a paper on alcohol treatment camps. I wrote a paper on Alaska Native, how Alaska Natives can market arts and crafts online. Nobody ever did a paper on that. I was in here in Anchorage. I did a paper on homelessness, Native homelessness in Anchorage, and I worked closely with Gloria O'Neill, the president of the CITC. She and I worked together excellently and made some progress on that issue at the time. This was in 2009. I went to the Otnas and I helped them document like the impacts that the first pipeline had, because at the time Palin was proposing another pipeline. Just the environmental impacts, the social impacts, all the money they got and how that negatively affected them. It affected them positively, but there's negative consequences of getting money too from that. And though I don't want to go too into other people's issues, I'm just saying, you know, I used my master's degree to help different tribes with like the issues and stuff, you know. Anyways, so all my grad papers were done, and so now was my big huge project. And I remembered those elder tapes that were left by a school teacher named Debbie Miller. She left Arctic Village in 1980, but she came back with her own money, and she recorded all these elders for a whole winter in Arctic Village. And they were just sitting in the UAF archives for 30 years. And I just heard, like, I forgot how, but I think it was my grandpa. He translated just one sentence of one of them. I was like, wow, it sounds like really interesting stories in there. So I got the grant from Humanities Forum, as I said, and hired my grandpa. The grant ran out, and I thought it was only going to be 2 weeks. 2 months later, Grant was long gone, and it was nowhere near being done. So I had to, what I did was I turned the project into my master's project and used the university's resources to get it done. It took about 8-9 months, I think the following April, but I got it done. All my classes were over by then, too. It was just the project. And so these elder stories, I talk so much about them. I don't know how much time I have left, but by the way, after Anchorage, I came all the way home. I stopped in Copper Center and all the way up, and stopped in Circle, stopped all the Native communities all the way home to reach my grandpa at his hotel room in Fairbanks, and where we just right away just started translating. So really quick, I'll just run through the stories. They have accounts of like the long ago, climate changes, intertribal warfare that they tried their best to quell. And
do you have a certain passage you want to share?
Yeah, just a second. There's an excellent one I want to share over the radio about. I'm glad you asked that. There's an excellent one. It's about the dog. It's about the man and the dog. It's a very small story, but it explains so much about how much has changed from the old Native life to the modern world. I'm trying to find it right now. Sorry.
We're able to edit, so no problem.
Okay. Okay, it has to be around here somewhere. Oh, okay, I found it. I found it, yeah. Okay, so I am 207. There's an elder named Stephen Peter. Stephen said since the Guichin lived so close to animals, they knew how to hunt them easy. But since Guichin have been living in villages, that knowledge is gone. And he does an excellent job of explaining the transition right here. Stephen explained the line of development. This is on page 207. I'm just reading from my book. Stephen explained the line of development in Arctic Village. First came caribou skin huts. Then people bought canvas tents at the trading posts in Fort Yukon. Then wood stoves were introduced and used in the canvas tents, which made life a little easier, more easier. Then a man from Canada taught the Gwich'in how to build log cabins, and now we all have log cabins. So he says long time ago they had to take a dog team to Fort Yukon to go to the store once a year, and then they had a small airport and they got stuff easier, and then they built a store in Arctic Village and they built a school in Arctic Village where they didn't have to travel at all. So you see how he does an excellent job of explaining how easier it got, you know. Which has bad stuff to it too, but I don't want to go into that. It just creates laziness too. But anyways, this is the passage I really want to read. I had to read the Stephen part to get to this part. This is my favorite passage I'm going to read here. It's on page 211. Grandpa Trimble made interesting contrasts, like in the Guichin legend of To'itin. To'itin tried to speak to his dog, but dog don't understand, Grandpa said. This part of the story is perfectly illustrates the Guichin's transition into the modern world, even in their stories, because they could no longer communicate with animals, a trait so common to native people in ancient times. So to me that's just such a powerful line. It just says so much. It's just one line, but it says so much to me about how much native people's worlds have changed from, because we used to talk to animals and now we're like, you know, we can't talk to a dog, you know, and so we lost a lot of power, I believe, you know. That's what that sentence told me by coming into the modern world. It's like we all have all these luxuries, like me and you have all these luxuries, but what did it cost us, you know?
Right. Well, if you're just joining us, I've been talking with Matthew Gilbert, an author of a new book called Sitting at Their Feet, a young Guichin Athabascan's memoir. Matthew, it's been a pleasure having you. Anything else you'd like to add?
No, thanks. I'm just glad to be here, and I'm glad to be lucky enough to be here on the radio, and I hope everyone out there is having a good summer. I hope it cools down for all our sakes.
Thank you.
Okay.